You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help. We're joined today by David Kennedy, David Turk, and Howard Safer. David Kennedy is a curator of collections and exhibits at the U.S. Marshals Museum in Fort Smith, Arkansas. His responsibilities include care of collections objects, historical research, and integration of the collections into museum exhibits, both virtual and physical. He is the author of Guns of the Wild West, a photographic tour of the guns that shaped our country's history, and the content advisor for Catherine Brevard's The Story of Guns, How They Changed the World. David Turk has served as historian in the United States Marshals Service since October 2001. He's only the second person to hold this position. His service with the agency dates from February 1990 and included 6 years with the agency's enforcement division. He's author of 6 books, including Forging the Star, the official modern history of the United States Marshals Service, and the remainder touch on various historical topics, including the outlaw Billy the Kid. In addition, he penned articles for numerous journals and magazines, including appearances in Police Chief and Wild West. And Howard Safer is currently the chairman of Safer Intelligence and Security. His abilities have been earned over a public and private sector career, including successful experience as police commissioner of New York City, director of operations for the United States Marshal Service, assistant director of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, fire commissioner of New York City, chairman and CEO of leading DNA forensics laboratory Bode Technology Group, chairman and CEO of a leading risk mitigation firm, and consultant to the chairman of Choice Point. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
Good to be with you.
So we're talking today about the hunt for Joseph Mengele, and name may ring a bell to a lot of listeners. It certainly is something that if you've studied World War II history or the Nazis, that name has popped up. But it's possible that a lot of people don't necessarily know why he was so wanted and so infamous. Can you talk a little bit about where he lays down as one of the most notorious Nazi war criminals? Because it's more than just someone like Goebbels or someone like Himmler. He had an even more kind of vile background that made him more wanted perhaps than others might have been.
I guess probably the best way to describe him is by his nickname. His nickname was the Angel of Death. And he was a doctor at Auschwitz concentration camp. And as the Jews who were being moved from the various countries that they were being taken from by the Nazis were brought into the camp, he would stand at the railroad station and he would say, you go to the left, you go to the right. Those who went to the left went to the gas chambers. Those who went to the right went to the internment camp. And then as a doctor, he was interested in experimenting, particularly on Jews who were twins and dwarfs and people with abnormalities. And one of the reasons that he did that was he wanted to find out how people fared in ice cold, how twins were born so that he could create this Aryan race. It's estimated he probably killed not hundreds, but thousands of people. So when you think of a murderer of thousands of people, it's amazing that he got to escape and lived as long as he did before he died peacefully, unfortunately, in Brazil. So that's why we're so interested in Joseph Mengele. Most people remember Adolf Eichmann being snatched by the Israelis in Argentina. Well, Mengele was there, but they did not get him. So that's why he's such an important fugitive.
Well, if you talk about killing people, and this is, he's much more hands-on than a lot of the other Nazis, right? I mean, Hitler is the ringleader, and many of the people in the Nazi high command were certainly responsible for the 6 million Jewish dead, and, you know, way more than that when it comes to total number, when you add gypsies and everyone else. But Mengele was the one actually being in the dirt, hands-on, killing people. Maybe not him personally, but even probably in some cases it was. But
it was him personally.
Yeah, directly ordering the deaths of you, versus whole groups of people.
Well, you know, there were many Nazis who ordered the deaths, but somebody who actually hands-on experimented with people. I mean, he would take twins and throw them in ice water for hours to see how long they survived. He would extract the eyes out of twins to see the color and how he could create some genetic formula to increase the master race. And he often said that he did not consider the Jews people. He just considered them things to experiment with. When you have somebody that's evil, that's why this investigation was right. So important.
Well, you brought up the Israelis and Adolf Eichmann, the idea of them hunting him down and grabbing him. This sounds like a job for the Israelis. How did the United States Marshals Service go after a Nazi war criminal? This wasn't somebody that broke out of San Quentin, or this wasn't somebody that we were chasing because they had been in the United States. This is someone who never set foot in the country. How did, you know, going back to the Wyatt Earp era marshals, how did that turn into an investigation of your organization?
Well, the way it came about was that the Attorney General was visited by Senator Alphonse D'Amato, who was head of the Judiciary Committee at the time, and he had hearings of twins who were survivors of Auschwitz and who had been survivors of Dr. Mengele. And at the end of the hearing, many of the witnesses said, the United States is doing nothing to find Joseph Mengele, who they believed to still be alive. So the Attorney General called in Rudy Giuliani and Jeff Harris, who were an Associate Attorney General and a Deputy Associate Attorney General, and said, find some agency to go out and find Mengele. And Rudy and Giuliani and Jeff Harris knew that the Marshal Service had this great capability of finding fugitives. And I got called over to the Department of Justice. And at the Department of Justice, they asked me if I would be willing to put a task force together to find Joseph Mengele. Well, my first reaction was, what crime did he commit in the United States? And they said, well, it's very important to the Attorney General that we find him. It is possible that he might have come into the United States, and when he did, he committed an immigration crime. So therefore, that's our jurisdiction.
Why not?
Now, I personally was thrilled to be given this assignment because I'm Jewish.
Okay.
So,
and this has to be the dream assignment for a marshal, too, right?
Right.
The manhunt of all manhunts.
Manhunt of all manhunts. And so we put a task force together. And the task force that we put together involved some of the best fugitive hunters in the country. Back then, you know, computers weren't widely used in law enforcement. We got a computer and dedicated it only to the Mengele investigation. And we set about learning as much as we could about the Nazis, about the Underground Railroad that they had. And then we decided to go talk to people who were knowledgeable on Mengele.
Let me ask one of the Davids, either one of you, whichever one decided makes more sense for this, because you'd mentioned, Howard, that the idea was that maybe he had been in the United States. Now, maybe it's a concocted way of getting some kind of indictment, but there were rumors, certainly even at the time, 1985, when you're talking about, that either he was in U.S. custody at one point or even had been helped, kind of a Klaus Barbie situation, helped to get to South America by U.S. intelligence. Was this something that was seriously considered in the early investigation of trying to figure out, was this the case or not?
Do you want to start?
Go ahead.
Well, there was rumors, of course, but I don't particularly think there were strong rumors. I mean, you probably, I know yourself, Mr. Safer, but I think there were just rumors to that effect. But they had to sort through literally thousands of leads to find that out.
Yeah, and that's really one of the amazing things. Just like with any investigation for any fugitive, somebody goes and shoots a cop today, you're going to have leads just get called in. And if that person is gone, if the person escapes justice for more than a few days, you're going to get some really, in some cases, almost insane leads. Some of the leads that came in from a number of people across the country regarding the Mengele case, everything from psychics who had visions that Mengele was hiding someplace. There were people saw him. I saw him at this bar in Miami, Florida. I saw him at the grocery store.
One in Wheaton, Maryland.
Wheaton, Maryland. There was a restaurant in Wheaton, Maryland. Yeah. Somebody saw him. They're sure that this was Mengele in this restaurant in Wheaton.
Well, there's a rumor, too, that he had gone into the United States to Houston to get medical treatment. I read that was one of kind of the key rumors.
We did have that rumor. We discounted it fairly quickly. One of the things about this investigation was how to focus on it. And the fact is that Mengele's movements were pretty well documented from the time that the war ended until the time he got to Brazil. The issue was, where was he?
Right.
Okay, so one of the things that we set about doing was going to the experts on Nazi hunting. So we flew over to Vienna, met with Simon Wiesenthal. Simon Wiesenthal was probably the world's number one Nazi hunter. He had located literally hundreds of Nazi war criminals to help prosecute them. So I flew over with one of my supervisors, Dom Ferrone, and met with Simon Wiesenthal in Vienna. He did not have any current information, but what he did do was he gave me business cards. And on those business cards, he wrote, "Howard is my friend. Help him."
Yeah.
For Argentina, Paraguay, and Brazil. And we used those cards when we went eventually to those countries to hunt for Mengele. Just to put it in context, this is unfortunately a story of missteps and confusion by both the German government, the Israeli government, and the American government, because we had him in 1945.
Right.
In 1945, he was detained by the U.S. military. They were looking for literally thousands of war criminals. He was actually detained in his own name. And they figured it was not the Joseph Mengele because he did not have a SS tattoo.
Well, that was the thing, the whole idea of the only way that they could have processed all these people as quickly as they did was looking for some indicators. And the indicator in this case was the blood type tattoo,
right?
The SS.
So what happened then was he actually went to work in farming in Germany. And, excuse me, in 1949, he left from Genoa, and I believe he was helped probably by people like Otto Skorzeny, who led the Nazi Underground Railroad.
Right.
And he went from Genoa to Argentina, and in Argentina, he actually lived a number of years as Joseph Mengele. In fact, one of the bizarre things in this case is he was a salesman in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, for the Mengele farm equipment company, his father's company.
Right. I mean, his family name is actually, well, I mean, it's like Deere, right? Like John Deere in many – it's – the family itself was pretty well respected inside Germany, even though it sounds like from everything I've read that the family was probably the most complicit group in helping him escape and staying supported and in existing.
No question. In fact, I've been – right outside the Mengele factory, which still exists today in Germany. And the fact is they supported him with money. He actually went back and visited his son Ralph in Switzerland with a West German passport that he got by going to the West German embassy in Argentina, got a birth certificate in the name of Joseph Mengele and a passport in the name of Joseph Mengele. So for years and years, this man went from Argentina to Paraguay to Brazil, very often using his own name.
Right. Did he live for years in Paraguay under his own name as well?
He did.
Yeah.
But you have to understand that we went to Paraguay on this investigation, that the president of Paraguay was a man named Stroessner. Stroessner was of German heritage, and Stroessner was also very pro-German.
Right.
I literally have pictures of whole villages in Paraguay where people are wearing Nazi armbands well after the war.
Right. I mean, that's the whole idea about Argentina and Brazil. You know, Argentina especially, you've got a lot of people running around named Adolfo in Argentina who are second or third generation Germans. I mean, that that had to have been when you started this investigation, like, yeah, he's in Argentina or he's in that area of the world.
Well, we put together a three-country task force, Germany, Israel, and the United States. And we all agreed to do our own separate investigations, but to collaborate. And we met with the prosecutor in Germany, whose name was Hans Klein, who had this case for many years, and it went without resources. When we all started making noise about it,
right,
suddenly he was very happy. He found resources, and he was very helpful. And when we met in Germany, one of the things we said was, we need to follow the money. And it's not like the Germans had not done anything in this case. They had interviewed lots of people relative to Mengele, including somebody named Hans Sedlmayr. And Hans Sedlmayr was a accountant/manager. And they believed, and we believed as well, that if anybody was in contact with Mengele, it would have been Hans Sedlmayr.
I want to ask you, Howard, in a second about the working with other U.S. agencies, whether it's CIA or DOD and state. But let's get some historical context before we chime into that. Let's talk about historically how the Marshal Service has worked with its partners, whether it's the FBI or other federal law enforcement, but also looking at foreign national security-based manhunts overseas and how they've worked traditionally with agencies like CIA or others in past investigations.
Okay, so you were referring to overseas or domestic?
Both. I mean, kind of more interagency cooperation across the bay.
Well, I think, of course, you know, in the witness security area, of course, we've had the exchange of spies that was quite well known, which Mr. Safer probably could refer to as well, across the bridge, which was, you know, that was in the, what was it, 89, 80, 87?
89 and 89, and in fact, it was at the Glenicke Bridge between West Berlin,
right,
and East Berlin. And this is an interesting bridge. In fact, there was a movie made about
it. Yeah, Abel and Powers were
Colonel Abel's and Francis Gary Powers were exchanged there. But the interesting thing that I found, and some of the people in this room, like Al Batney, were there with me, was that it was a bridge used only for one thing, spy exchanges.
Yep.
It had a galvanized fence in the middle. The West German side was beautiful, painted, paved. The East German side was rusted, grass growing up. But we did two spy exchanges there, and the Marshal Service was picked because they knew we knew how to do those things.
Right.
Among other things, of course, our extraditional responsibilities put us in cooperation. It always has been. It's not as much of an espionage sort of activity, but you know, that has also been part of it. Domestically, probably one of the most interesting historical stories occurred in the War of 1812. It was part of the Battle of New Orleans in 1815. It didn't take place on foreign soil. It took place on our own when the British had already actually signed a peace treaty.
Right. The war was technically over by the time Andrew Jackson.
It was already over.
Yeah.
And the British decided to take one last swipe at us in New Orleans. And Andrew Jackson was taking the overland route. And he had to employ, luckily, we had a very sharp U.S. Marshal in New Orleans by the name of Peter Duplay. We were very, very fortunate. He had a nice little spy network locally that happened to be pirates. One of them was, you probably well known, as the Lafitte brothers.
Yep.
And one was in jail, held by us, and we literally let him out of jail. That was part of the deal, to let him spy on the British, to allow the best movements of that British ship. And we actually chose the ground, you know, as a part of that. It wasn't the best ground, but, you know, the Chalmette is where they ended up fighting the Battle of New Orleans. We had actually were better provisioned at that point. They lost. The battle is well known, quite badly, partly because of maneuvering. The British maneuvers didn't improve that. But that was no small part thanks to that spy network. So we did have that. Of course, we have sequestered juries, and, you know, that is somewhat on, you know, spy work, espionage work. Mm-hmm. We have that sort of thing, including the famous Jimmy Hoffa case. You know, we had numerous sequestered juries there and guarding witnesses, in which I could go on that, but I won't.
Unless you're going to tell us where he is.
Then no, but I can tell you one of our deputies got in hot water for taking Hoffa to a restaurant, one of his favorite restaurants near Detroit, and got in quite hot water for it. Somehow he coerced him into going to one of those restaurants and got quite big trouble for it. But things of that nature. But we don't know, Civil War, we were we had to do several spy busts for Copperheads, when there's no Southern Sympathizers, you know, during that particular point. So those are some historical tangents.
And I think more from a modern perspective, and this is coming in as essentially an outsider to the Marshals Service. At the Marshals Museum, I'm not an employee of the service, but we work hand in hand, and we get a lot of information from them, and we're very fortunate to have the relationship we do. Coming in as an outsider, domestically, the Marshals Service is very much a force multiplier for city, county, state, federal law enforcement, the resources they're able to apply to cases, and the participation and the work that they receive, the assistance they receive from those same organizations to get their respective missions done. When it goes to foreign involvements, I think what a lot of people miss is when they think of national police, they think of the FBI. But when you look at most other nations, their national police organizations are much more closely organized and have the responsibilities similar to what the Marshals Service has in the United States. So they're very much similar organizations, similar missions. And viewing it as an outsider, I get to see how those same organizations, that's one of the reasons why they work so well together with the Marshals Service, is because they're essentially doing the same job right. for the different nations, and they work much more on a level basis rather than being, this in the way of the FBI, almost an internal intelligence organization, law enforcement organization that does investigative work, or the CIA doing external intelligence gathering and operations.
Well, this investigation, you've already talked about it including multiple countries, Germany and Israel, and certainly you're dealing with South American countries as you're moving through them. What other organizations? You have to think, obviously, Department of State may have been involved since you're trampsing about the world. But did you draw upon the resources of the intelligence community? Did you talk to CIA? Did you work closely with those that had maybe the information, the sources overseas that you may not have had?
Absolutely. Of course, relative to the Department of State, we try to keep them out of it as much as possible. Department of State is about diplomacy. Yes. Catching fugitives is not about diplomacy. But we did work closely with the CIA. At the time, Claire George was the deputy director of operations. Claire and I became very good friends and worked on a number of operations together. In this operation, Claire alerted his chiefs of station in Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay to help us. And they did help us. Unfortunately, they didn't help us catch him.
Right.
But they did provide us with a lot of information. And in fact, we went to Buenos Aires and went to the place where, and this is an interesting part of the story, where Adolf Eichmann had been seized by the Mossad in 1960. And what happened then, and most people don't realize, when the Mossad went to Argentina, they were looking to catch two people, not just Eichmann. They were looking for Mengele. And here's where history has two separate stories, depending on who you're listening to. One story has Eichmann living in his apartment building a few blocks away. And when he heard about Mengele living in an apartment building a few blocks away, and when he heard about Eichmann, he then fled to Paraguay. The other story is that he had already gone to Paraguay. Mm. But interestingly enough, through history, right after the Mossad grabbed Eichmann, the appetite for Israelis catching Nazi war criminals waned. And even though they had an opportunity to catch Mengele and knew where he was, the people at the top of the Israeli government said, we have to worry about surviving, right. about the Arab wars, about our economy. So pretty much that investigation in Israel went dormant during those years.
Even as successful as the apprehension of Eichmann was, for the Israelis, there was some geopolitical issues involved with that. I mean, they basically had violated the sovereignty of a foreign nation. Yeah.
Well, so has the Marshal Service often. You know, the fact is that U.S. law, and this is what's important in this investigation, there's a Supreme Court decision called Kerr versus Bee. And basically what the Supreme Court said is that U.S. law enforcement officers can travel anywhere in the world, violate the laws of any country in the world to apprehend a fugitive, as long as they don't violate his civil rights or torture him or, you know, do those kind of things. But when he's returned to the court that holds the warrant, the judge is only going to ask why you were not here when you were supposed to be. And, you know, the Marshal Service, you know, we were able to apprehend Ed Wilson, a rogue CIA agent who murdered people. We were able to basically kidnap Juan Mata Ballesteros out of Honduras in violation of Honduran law. But he killed Kiki Camarena, a U.S. DEA agent. So, you know, those niceties are not important
right.
when you're in fugitive hunting. That's why we try and keep state at arm's length.
Right, exactly. They probably don't like that very much.
I've been at a few hearings where State Department wanted to know why we did what we did. But the important thing is that dangerous, important fugitives are returned, and nobody does it better than the U.S. Marshal Service.
How long, when you were brought into the investigation, did you think you might be able to catch him alive? So I know that there was the understanding, or at least the belief, that there was a body that could have been Mengele since very early in the investigation. But did you believe that there's a chance that he was still, that that wasn't him, that you could still probably catch him alive?
I was hopeful from the beginning that we could catch him alive. And I was incredibly disappointed when we found, you know, his remains. Because basically, he did these horrible things, one of the worst human beings that ever walked the earth. And then he lived a good number of years doing what he wanted to do, and then died like any grandfather would die, you know, with the people he was living with, grandkids, while swimming, of a stroke. You know, that was the worst possible outcome.
Right.
I wanted to see him in the dock.
Well, one thing that's interesting is, in any kind of investigation like this, and this is true when it comes to intelligence analysis and everything else, is even if you had caught someone you thought might have been Joseph Mengele, there are so many difficulties associated with identifying the person, because it's not like today
right.
where you have a digital photograph that you can age, you know,
well,
using
DNA.
A computer. Yeah, DNA certainly helped. That
right.
didn't come until much later.
DNA didn't come until 1984. This is another interesting part. When we found him, the remains, and after we had put together a forensic team, chief medical examiner of Delaware, forensic dentist, forensic anthropologist, you know, all of the kind of people who would do the forensic examination. And they said it was a 99.9% probability that this was Joseph Mengele. Israelis had a forensic team did the same thing. Germans had a forensic team did the same thing. Okay? Yet, when I called Simon Wiesenthal and told him, he said, couldn't be him. I still to this day have no idea why he took that attitude. When I told Senator D'Amato ordered me not to release information that this was Joseph Mengele. I said, Senator, we're going to do it. And I did, and he didn't like me much because of it. But then, to get to the end here of identification, in 1992, his son Roth gave a DNA sample. We matched it against the remains, and there was no doubt whatsoever. This was the bones of Joseph Mengele.
Well, even going back before that, before you actually had a body to compare it to, the problem was associated with the fact that there was no modern photograph of him. I think 1958 was the last known photograph.
Right.
And then you talk about the fingerprints. There was a lot of discussion about whether or not those were actually Mengele's fingerprints. And then with the body itself, this is interesting for me as kind of someone who looks at historic documents to try to figure out. It's possible his medical records were wrong because of a disease that he thought he may have had. He may not have had something different. And there's a lot of it.
I disagree with that.
Okay.
We got the medical records from the German Documentation Center. One of the things the Germans did meticulously was document everything. And it said that he had osteomyelitis, and there were signs of that in the body. Okay, they did everything from measuring hat size. We have these photographs of them putting Wolfgang Gerhardt's hat on the skull to measure it. Now, there was no question in my mind that this was Josef Mengele. The question in my mind was why Simon Wiesenthal didn't want to admit it. Right. And maybe it's part of what I found, unfortunately, with the Israeli part of this investigation. They were not very active in it. The Germans were. And, you know, my sense that maybe holding the specter of Nazi war criminals being out there was important politically, because the biological clock was ticking.
Right.
These people were going to be dead anyway.
Right. Eventually, they were going to die of old age, unfortunately, like Mengele does. Was there any concern, and I've read this in the DOJ report, was there any concern that Mengele, through all of his medical training and through the, you know, how much he knew about the body, I mean, this is so Law and Order kind of question, but it popped up in the DOJ report of finding a body that would have had similar characteristics to his and kind of faking his own death, because he had in the past faked his own death and his family had been complicit in pushing those rumors going back to the 1940s.
It was possible, but we didn't have any evidence of that. But speaking of medical, he was actually interviewed by the Argentine police because he was allegedly doing abortions while he was in Buenos Aires as a doctor. And they let him go.
We'll be right back after this.
And now a word from our sponsor, SpyCloud, the leader in operationalizing cybercrime analytics. Traditional threat intelligence is a thing of the past. Cyber criminals are stealing vast amounts of credentials, session cookies, and financial data every day, and it's hard to keep up. SpyCloud is the trusted partner businesses turn to fully understand their darknet exposure risk and neutralize threats before it's too late. SpyCloud alerts your organization as soon as an employee or customer's data appears on the darknet, so you can act faster than bad actors to prevent cyber attacks like ransomware, session hijacking, account takeover, and online fraud. With insights from the industry's largest repository of recaptured data, protect the digital identities and systems most important to your business. Get your free corporate darknet exposure report at spycloud.com/cyberwire and see what information criminals have in their hands today. That's spycloud.com/cyberwire.
So let me ask a question, and this can be across the board. Reading this, we're using counterfactual hindsight in this case, and we're kind of judging those in the 1940s the kind of way that we would treat it and would say, if I was there, I would do it different. It's like, if I had met Hitler when he was 20 years old, I would have punched him out. Well, we had him in 1945. We had Josef Mengele in 1945 in American custody. Should we have had him then? Should we have caught him then? Or is it unfair to second guess?
Hindsight is 20/20. Yeah. You know, think about Germany in 1945. Millions of displaced persons, thousands of people who are all swearing they never served in the SS, and if they were in the Wehrmacht, then they just followed orders. You know, very confused times. Certainly there were mistakes made, but they're understandable mistakes. We had laser focus on one individual. They were dealing with thousands.
And this is another hindsight question. I mean, Mengele died in 1979.
Yes.
If you had been sent in 78, would you have gotten him?
Probably. Yeah. I believe that our people are so good, and we had such help from both Nazi hunters and the intelligence community, that I believe we absolutely would have found him, because there were many, many documents. I mean, the Israelis knew where he was way before he died. They just chose not to go get him.
Did this set a precedent, or at least create a model for overseas relationships and cooperation? Because I know, and even, you know, people know that maybe it's the story of El Chapo and others that have been fugitives, not necessarily of the United States, but there's been cooperation across the board between the Marshal Service and others. Was the Mengele investigation used as a model for how to do this kind of thing in the future?
It was partly used, but, you know, the fact is the Marshal Service has great relations overseas. You know, their witness security program is the best in the world. We have shown many countries how to put a witness security program together. We've had representatives at Interpol since early 80s. So, it's a cliche, but the truth is the service is always known to fugitives. You can run, but you can't hide. And that is could not be truer today. Nobody arrests more fugitives than the U.S. Marshals Service, and nobody does it better.
Well, you mentioned WITSEC, and I think that actually several of you have. There might be an interesting concept with the idea of spies ending up dead all over the place now. I mean, do you see that as a concern moving forward about people who – I mean, the Skripal one in Europe was an interesting one. The idea in the U.K. was this was someone who had been traded.
Right.
Someone who's supposed to be off limits and kind of now it's open season to a respect. Do you see someone as, a group as good as the Marshal Service in keeping people alive being brought in more?
Let me give you some historical perspective, which I don't think has ever been made public before. When I was chief of witness security at the Marshal Service, Claire George and I sat down and talked about the Marshal Service taking over the CIA defector program. Because from an intelligence agency's perspective, you get a defector, you get a spy, you bleed him of all his intelligence, and then he becomes a pain in the butt.
Right.
And very often they go off on their own and are subject to the kind of things that we've seen in Europe. So we were planning to move the defector program to the Marshal Service, and then unfortunately Iran-Contra came along, and everything, all deals were off the table. So I think that's something that's probably worth revisiting, because nobody does witness security better than the Marshal Service. I can tell you that they have never lost a witness, and so
that's extraordinary.
Some people will dispute that, like Geraldo Rivera did, and I sued him in federal court and won because he claimed that we lost somebody, and we never have.
Well, you'd think. I mean, the way to keep people defecting is to guarantee their safety. Right. And if all of a sudden people end up dead, then that makes it really problematic. And so the marshals would be, to me, the perfect.
The deal is, if you follow the rules of the program and you don't get kicked out, that's
right.
Then you're safe. But, those who leave the program, then they're on their own.
Well, that's an important point. The fact is, witnesses, whether criminal witness or intelligence witnesses, take a lot of care and feeding. And most intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies are not equipped to do that.
Right.
The service has developed a program which basically, from the day you come in and until you die, peacefully, hopefully, you are taken care of by the service. And that's why they do so well.
Can that be a model moving into the future? I mean, you talked about maybe this doesn't happen tomorrow, where witness protection or of defected spies or others is taken over. Do you see the agencies kind of following your model?
I would hope so. I would hope so, because it's going to be in this digital age, it is so much harder to hide somebody.
Right.
You can go on Google and in 10 minutes, I'll know more about you than you ever wanted me to know. The privacy thing, that ship has sailed. So what we need to do is we need to have an organization that can protect you from both digital intrusion as well as physical. And, the service is equipped to do that. You need a dedicated group.
Right.
And that's what the Marshal Service has.
Well, in many respects, as you're talking about it, it's basically a counterintelligence investigation. You're trying to prevent the bad guys.
Of course.
From learning about, I've thought about it a lot, of the digital revolution from an espionage perspective and from an intelligence counterintelligence, but keeping someone alive really makes a lot of sense when it comes in.
And you have to be prepared to move them again.
Right.
I'll tell you a very quick story that I found fascinating. When I was chief of witness security, we got a call one day from a protected witness who said he had just been elected sheriff in an organization. Here's a guy with a big criminal background. And what happened...
That's amazing. Go ahead.
And what happened is the people who were running against him hired an ex-FBI agent who discovered that he was a protected witness. So suddenly, this guy is in huge danger.
Right.
And you need an organization that can pick him up, move him, and relocate him, give him a new identity. And that's what the Marshal Service does. Nobody else does that.
On the other hand, let me ask you this question historically, and this could be for anyone. were there people in South America doing that for Nazi war criminals?
Absolutely.
On the other, I think, the other side of witness protection for them.
Otto Skorzeny, who was known as Hitler's commando, he's the guy who tried to rescue Mussolini.
Yeah, it's the one with the scar that, the scar. Basically Blofeld was based on in respect.
Well, Otto Skorzeny moved to Costa del Sol, where he unfortunately also died at old age. But he ran this whole organization. When you look at Mengele, Mengele lived with families who knew who he was. And they helped facilitate moving him, documentation, looking for threats, counterintelligence, as you say. So absolutely. You know, hundreds of Nazi war criminals didn't end up in Argentina by mistake.
Right.
You know, the Perones were very pro-Nazi.
Right. I think Skorzeny actually worked for Juan Perón as like a personal bodyguard in many respects.
In fact, one of the first things I did when this case was assigned to us was I read Otto Skorzeny's book.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting concept, too, the idea of kind of getting inside of the version of you on the other side, right? Because you're... You, when you were the head of WITSEC, you're kind of thinking about how do I keep people from finding out where my guys are. Now you're the opposite. You're kind of attacking your version of you overseas is how do I get through that person trying to protect other people's identities.
We always taught this and continue to teach this in fugitive hunting. You got to crawl into the guy's mind and where he's going to go and what he's going to do. And that's the way you find him. You know, we did that in... looking for Christopher Boyce. Mm-hmm. Christopher Boyce, for those who don't know who he was probably one of the most damaging spies in the history of the United States. He sold all the codes to our satellites, our spy satellites, to the Russians. And amazingly, he did it by throwing a rock through the U.S. Embassy in Mexico saying, I have important information for the Russians. And the KGB said, come on down.
Right.
But we were able to catch him, and it took a number of years, by thinking about what he would do and where he would go.
It's one thing when you're getting inside the head of a spy, when you get inside the head of someone who's murdered people and broken out of prison. It's got to be a very different thing as a Jewish person to get inside the head of Joseph Mengele and try to think about where he might, what decisions he might make. How problematic was that kind of from a personal perspective?
Well, it wasn't, because I used the tradecraft that I knew. And fortunately, I had great people working with me who were great fugitive hunters. And, you know, fortunately, I was in the position where I could make this a real priority. It was a priority of the Attorney General to make Senator D'Amato go away, but it was a priority of the Marshal Service to show that we could find anybody.
Right.
Because this was at a time when we had just regained the fugitive jurisdiction from the FBI, which made them quite unhappy. But we needed to show that we could be better than anybody else. Today, there's no question about it. But back then, there was concern. Could we find major fugitives?
So Mengele was found. I don't care alive or dead because Mengele was found. I know, obviously, it matters. But in the history of the Marshal Service, where does this rank as, like, top people? It's got to be really high to the top. I mean,
yes.
I think if he had been found alive, it would be number one by far. I mean, you've got a guy who... is so above and beyond the average common person that's being hunted down. But alive or dead, finding Mengele has to rank pretty high among the bad guys the marshals have hunted down.
Well, put it this way. When there was a Parade magazine that came out with our 15 Most Wanted, you know, a story by Peter Moss in 85, they had some of the first, you know, they were hyping up our 15 Most Wanted program, which Mr. Safer was instrumental in getting started. There was a picture there of Joseph Mengele with a big X through it. You know, that kind of tells you he was a big, that was a big find. There was no case like this before or since with that kind of historical, integrity in it. I mean, there was nothing like it. I can't think of, except for maybe the Alcatraz case, I can't think of any other case of its import. And as far as...
The ones that didn't catch, right? Frank, what's his name?
Frank Morris the two Anglin brothers.
I only know because
still
of the
alive case.
Movie, right? Yeah, still a live case.
However, that doesn't have the kind of impact socially that the Mengele case had for the very reasons Mr. Safer had. And like you know, I have Jewish roots as well. So it does have, you know, great social import.
But I think even going back to the 19th century and some of the big, you know, the villains of the Wild West and other places, that this would certainly rank up there.
In our modern history, though, if you take a look at our modern history, and of course, you know, going back and, you know, we have a 230 year history coming our way this year. You know, so it's, we were talking, if you're going to go back and talk about Wyatt Earp and Billy the Kid, right, and all of that, yes, it's still up there. It still holds.
A lot of what we've been doing in the last 15, 20 years in intelligence has been manhunting. Actually goes back into the 1990s, talk about the Balkans, where it was just a laundry list, right, of war criminals that we're chasing. This is one of the first major American federal government manhunts that's global.
Right.
How much of a model was this for what we've done since? I mean, did we forget some of it? Because we had to kind of learn it again in Bosnia a little bit. But the parameter set of interagency cooperation and working overseas and hunting down an individual, this is really kind of setting the standard for doing that.
It is. We were very fortunate that at the time we had great relations with just about every federal agency. We've always had great relations with state and local agencies. So, you know, we had an army of thousands that we could look to help. But, you know, the reality is we dedicated specific resources to this case. So it's not like, you know, most marshals are looking for lots of fugitives.
Right.
We put together a group that had one mission, and that mission was to find Joseph Mengele. We took a computer, which was like, for the Marshal Service, new equipment.
Well, in 1985,
then,
yeah.
Right, back then. And we dedicated it to following up thousands and thousands of the leads. So, you know, I think it set the model, but I think it was, I often tell people timing is very important. And this timing was perfect because from the top, from the Attorney General right down to us at the Marshal Service, there was never a question of resources.
Right.
And, of course, you can be the best fugitive hunter in the world. If you don't have the backing of the political machine and the dollars and people to do it, you're not going to be successful.
If people want to know more about the history of the Marshal Service without buying all the books that you've written, they should do that anyway. They should do that anyway. But if they want a quick, you know, is there a good website? Does the Marshal Service website do a pretty good job in talking about the Marshal's history?
Yeah, it's pretty comprehensive. We're in a course of redoing it now, but it's www.usmarshals.gov. And it's got a pretty comprehensive history section. Also, the U.S. Marshals, and Dave can tell you about that.
Yeah, the United States Marshals Museum, we're going to be opening up September 24th, 2019. That's the 230th anniversary of the signing of the Judiciary Act of 1789, when the Marshal Service was created, being signed into law by President George Washington. It was the very first thing that the U.S. Senate did during the very first U.S. Congress. It's the oldest agency that was created by the government. And we get a chance to tell that story. The building's going to be opening up. We're going to be the biggest element of that initially is going to be our Hall of Honor, recognizing the many people who have died in the line of duty. Right now, our unofficial list is looking at about 370 people over the history of our nation. The reason why we're in Fort Smith is because a third of that number died in what's now Oklahoma, half of them coming out of the U.S. District Court for Western Arkansas. And the people who came out of there, if you ever think of True Grit, if you ever think of Judge Parker, mm-hmm. that's what we're talking about.
Right.
But that's only a third of what we're going to be telling in the way of a story. We have an entire 230-year history that we'll be discussing. And that 230-year history includes from immediately following the foundation of our country and the acceptance of the United States Constitution all the way up to events which are taking place today and now. And so we get to tell a really exciting story. It involves everything from the Whiskey Rebellion to the Civil Rights movement across our country. We get to talk about the Vietnam War riots. We get to talk about how our country was being formed as we moved west across the nation, and how the marshals were the only law enforcement in the frontier west. We get to talk about what the job was that they did in other parts of our nation, whether you're running WITSEC, running the JPATS, the prisoner transport system. There's so many aspects of our nation's history and our nation's operations. If it was not for the Marshal Service, we would not have the nation operating the way it does.
Did I read that you were heavily involved in creating Con Air?
That's true.
So for our 20 to 30 year old men out there are going, really? So, yeah.
Terrible movie though.
Terrible movie.
Well, I get the pop culture questions all the time about spy movies. And if you think about it, there's a lot of, you know, from The Fugitive to U.S. Marshals will focus on The Fugitive to Con Air. And there's even the show. I was almost going to make a joke about there's a bunch of former spies and mobsters in Albuquerque because you've relocated all of them to New Mexico because there's that TV show about that. Is there good martial pop culture that's pretty representative of what the service is?
Well,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
I think the great pop culture is the sting operations that we ran.
Well, I mean, yeah, they're so good. They're absolutely might as well be. Yeah.
But what's important to realize is we're the ones who did it first.
Yeah.
Okay. We literally put together a program where we sent out letters to the last known address of 300 fugitives, telling them that they had won.
That was here in D.C., yes. Wasn't it? The Washington.
They had one.
Same time frame.
Such a good story. Tell it, please.
They had won a ticket to a Washington-Cincinnati NFL football game and the opportunity to win a ticket and an all-expense-paid vacation to the Super Bowl. And what they had to do is they had to show up at the Washington Convention Center on a Sunday with two forms of identification. Right, and they would get these tickets, and it would be a party. So what we did is we dressed one of our deputies up as the San Diego Chicken. We had all of our, this is probably sexist today, but we had all of our nice-looking female deputy marshals in short shorts and top hats with balloons. As they checked in, we looked at their ID. There was guys at a computer in another room checking to make sure the warrants were valid. The young lady deputies would hand them a balloon to keep their hands busy. They would escort them up to this big room. We had a large TV showing last year's Super Bowl. We had our chief of enforcement, Louis McKinney, in the top hat and tails, and he said, "Welcome, gentlemen. We have a surprise." And when he said surprise, the back door of this room opened, and our SWAT team, our special operations group, came in with long rifles, arrested everybody, and put them on a bus. There's two interesting things about that day. One, as the bus was leaving, one of the criminals shouted out, "Do we still get to go to the Super Bowl?" Obviously not a master criminal. Jeez. But out of those 300 letters, we arrested 101 fugitives at a cost of $22,000 per fugitive, which is amazingly reasonable. And then one last part of it, while I'm there watching this great thing going on, a lawyer shows up with a court order to cease and desist, because it was the beginning of cable TV. We represented ourselves as a cable TV station. Mm-hmm. He represented ESPN, which was just starting, and thought we were encroaching on their rights. So he said, "Oh, I'm very happy that you're not a TV station." He says, "I'll be going." I says, "No, you won't."
Right, exactly.
Yes.
It's like, you're not going anywhere. I think that they just made a documentary about that, if I believe. Yeah. I know I saw
actually,
that.
Actually, two. NFL Films did one, and ESPN did one.
And that was incredibly well. I for about half an hour, I bought into it. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, wait, what the hell is going on here? So if you haven't had a chat, maybe it's online. You can hunt it down.
It's on YouTube. Actually.
What an extraordinary story, too. This is brilliant.
And as an outsider, again, watching that and seeing the people who were involved in that whole operation were the best and brightest of the Marshal Service that time frame. Two of the people involved ended up becoming acting director and a director of the Marshal Service, first African-American, first female. You have the person in charge of Special Operations Group was the deputy. So many other deputies were striving to be at that level. He ended up actually being the marshal who lost his life at Ruby Ridge, Bill Deegan. It's just there are just like so many people. You could just start running down the list of everybody who was involved there that through the remainder of the 80s into the 90s and even into the 2000s were people who were really driving the organization and making the Marshal Service what it is today.
And I want your listeners to understand that, you know, all of the things we talked about are important and some of them sound like fun, but this is a very dangerous job.
Right.
We lost a deputy last week serving a warrant. And so, you know, just a little sobering thought that the men and women who do this are really committed, and they're the people who run into danger,
right,
while other people are running the other way.
Well, for you know, people out there who listen to this, we're very focused on the intelligence side of things, but there's an extraordinary amount of intelligence collection analysis when it comes to hunting down a fugitive. When it comes to, it's almost an amalgamation of police work and intelligence work, where it's not just a straightforward investigation of trying to catch the bad guy. You already know who the bad guy is.
Absolutely,
it's finding the bad guy. It's very much like what we're doing when we're hunting terrorists overseas or bad guys in the Balkans. It's using intelligence networks, sources, collection methods from signals, intelligence, and other things to find a person you already know is out there and already know is guilty.
And I will tell you that during my tenure, and I'm sure during the tenure of the people who are there now, we often come across intelligence that is important to the intelligence community. And that's why we have liaison with all of the three-letter agencies so that we can provide that intelligence. And I often see good things happening with our intelligence agencies, and I say to myself, I know where that came from.
Well, I imagine that goes in both directions,
absolutely,
too.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I really appreciate you taking the time. We kind of got off of the Mengele conversation, but I think it was really worth it because kind of talking – most people out there who listen to this podcast are really almost primarily focused on, you know, the CIAs and the DIAs and the NSAs of the world. It's rare that we get a chance to talk about an agency like the Marshal Service that's doing the same kinds of work, at least from a critical thinking and problem solving perspective, that these intelligence, you know, capital I intelligence agencies are doing. And I think it's clear, particularly in the case of both witness protection and the counterintelligence perspective and hunting down fugitives from the intelligence gathering perspective and analysis, that it's so, so similar. And so let me end it this way, because there are a lot of people who are thinking about careers. They're in grad school. They're listeners who are early career professionals. Maybe they're not in the agency they like. Maybe they're like, I just wanted to get in the door and I'm looking for my career. How do you get into the Marshal Service to do this kind of work? Is there career advice that you could provide?
Well, there's a test.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just gets you in the door.
Right.
Then you have to be interviewed and see if you have the kind of, not just intelligence, but the kind of passion that the majority of people in the service have. This is a relatively small agency, you know, compared, you know, I had 41,000 cops in the NYPD. I guess there's four or 5,000 marshals in the world. So you need an elite group of people who are committed and dedicated and willing to make some sacrifices.
Right.
Because, you know, very often you have to move your family for new assignments. Very often you don't get the kind of recognition that a lot of other people get. So it has to be in your blood.
Is there a new kind of is it not like necessarily like going to become an FBI agent where it's like become a lawyer or get a psychology degree or learn some languages? Is there something that makes them – is it now more be digitally proficient? Is it more languages you need, you know?
No, nowadays military you know, does help. Any kind of military service does help now. Now they are starting to hire more in the operational fields, and we are starting to grow a little bit past that time. But it's not we're still small. But we're growing a little bit. But it's comparatively speaking, Mr. Safer is absolutely correct. We're still very small. But there is strength in that. We work with others
right
that way, and there is a strength in that.
Being a former Marine, I equate Marshal Service to the Marine Corps. You know, they're the people. There aren't a lot of them.
Right.
But you know, there's that old saying in Texas Rangers. One riot, one ranger. Well, Marshal Service live up to that?
And I would very definitely agree with what Commissioner Safer just said. I've been in and around the military. I've been around law enforcement. I've studied a lot of history and current operations, military and law enforcement. And I had the pleasure and the opportunity to spend a day at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center watching a bunch of, like, I think of it now as kids going through the Marshals Service training. And they are some of the most impressive young people I have met. To a one, they are smart, they're well-spoken, they are willing to go above and beyond on physical challenges, on mental challenges. They have a very difficult job that they are learning to do in order to not just protect the courts, not just protect our country. They're also there to do the unenviable job of protecting the rights of the people they have in their custody, mm-hmm. while protecting themselves. And it's just, it's the mental gymnastics that they have to go through in order to do their job while they're going through one of the most physically demanding jobs I've seen. It's just mind boggling.
The split second decision making they have to make, and, you know, it requires, you know, that education as well. So,
Well, I mean, I think that's, as you've been talking about, this is not your safety school, right? This is not, if I can't get into the FBI, I'm going to join the Marshals. You absolutely have to be dedicated to wanting to do this job.
Yeah. And it's mental. It's physical. It is very much like, to the comment about being like the Marine Corps, it's very much Marine Corps or any special operations branch of any military. That's essentially kind of, in my mind, what you are looking at. This is not county police department work. This is steps and levels above.
David Kennedy, David Turk, and Commissioner Howard Safer, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast. I love these conversations because it is certainly intelligence related, but it's a nice breath of fresh air from kind of what we do normally do to get a chance to talk about a cool story like this. So really appreciate you guys taking the time to talk to us here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to SpyCast. Remember, every Tuesday we will post a new podcast available from both spymuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about SpyCast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @INTLSpycast. That's INTLSpycast. Talk to you next week.